But yeah, so I've been involved in tree rattling now for more than 20 years, which is kind of amazing, but it's true. Amazing to me, anyway, how the years just fly by. And pretty much that whole time I've been hearing about Dr. Ambedkar and the ex-untouchable Buddhists of India, or Dalits as they prefer to be known these days. And I've been hearing about our movement's connection with that community in India. And I've met, you know, a number of order members who are from India and who have, you know, come up through our movement in India. And about a third of our order members are Indian. They're from India. So it's quite a significant part of our community, and thousands of mitras, literally thousands of mitras, and thousands of other people who are involved. And, yeah, most of those Indian people who are involved in our movement are from the Dalit community. They're from the kind of bottom, really, of Indian society. It's worth reflecting that, I've just been thinking about this because I've been thinking about this talk for a few weeks, actually, and reading about it, and reading about the situation of the Dalits in India. And, quite a lot of them are just treated like slaves. It's quite incredible that it's slavery. Like, it's as bad as anything that happened in the south of America before the American Civil War. It's really that bad. It's slavery. It's more invisible because there's no race difference. So if you go to India, you don't really see it because you're not aware of what's going on. Sometimes you do, if people point it out to you, you do see it, but it's basically slavery. It's quite incredible, and it's going on, and very few people are making a noise about it. It's really quite incredible. And then, you know, people are completely disempowered, completely disenfranchised, and forced to do menial tasks for other people. And it has, the really incredible thing is it has religious sanction. So the religion actually that persists in India actually encourages that. It's just really incredible. It's like it's hard to countenance. It's just think, wow, that's crazy. Crazy that nobody talks about it and criticizes it. It's outlawed. Our untouchability is outlawed by the Constitution of Independent India, but it still goes on. So Ambedkar, of course, comes from that community, and his story is a very inspiring story. Even just on the level of the triumph of, you know, the human spirit against really incredible odds, just on that level, it's very inspiring. And of course, he set in motion what Indian order members call Dhamma Kranti, or Dhamma Revolution. So there's a real flavour, particularly when you talk to Indian order members, of revolution. There's a particular flavour that you get with that word, and they take that very, very seriously. And it's very inspiring because it makes you realise that what we're doing is a revolution. We don't really think about it like that, and it feels all quite quiet and quite polite, but actually it is a revolution, a radical attitude to life. And I've been, yeah, like I said, I've been hearing about this over the years. I've been hearing about it in talks by particularly Subhuti. He's given quite a number of talks. He spends a lot of time in India, and he's very much a kind of a disciple, really, you could say, of Ambedkar, and other Western order members. And also I've heard from Indian order members, and they've highlighted the significance of Ambedkar. I've also read books about Ambedkar. So years ago I read a book called Jai Bin, which is a book by an order member called Naga Bodhi, about the very early days of our movement in India, in the early 80s, I think it was, when he was there. He writes about it. It's a very, very interesting book. Banto's memoirs, of course, he talks a lot about this, and his meetings with Ambedkar, and his involvement with the ex-untouchable Buddhists. And he wrote a book called Ambedkar and Buddhism, which talks about Ambedkar from the perspective of his engagement with Buddhism. I mean, a lot of other people have written about Ambedkar from all different kinds of perspectives, but that's very much looking at him from the perspective of his engagement with Buddhism. I've also spent some time in India. I've been there a couple of times. And there's something really I find strangely kind of inspiring about this story. And a lot of it comes down to, I think, for me at least, this is I'm speaking personally here, just the difference that taking on a new identity can make for people. After there was this mass conversion in 1956, millions of people have converted since then, but even on that day in October of 1956, it's their estimates, but they reckon about 380,000 people converted to Buddhism in one day. So it's a lot of people. And Bante had a lot to do with them after that time. And he would ask them, what difference has it made to you being a Buddhist? You know, what difference does it make? And what he was talking to people who were absolutely at the bottom of the heap, terribly poor, deprived people. And he said, now that I'm a Buddhist, I feel free. But that's what they said. It's quite an inspiring thing because, in a way, politically, economically, they weren't. But they felt, that's the way they felt, socially, psychologically, and spiritually, they felt free. So there's something about that I think that's really interesting, how the way you think about who you are and the way you think about where your place is changes your experience really radically. So yes, I've been hearing about India, I've read about it, I've heard, talked to people about Dr. Ambedkar, and like I said, I visited there a couple of times. And more recently, I visited there 5 years ago, and I think the first time I was there, I was just kind of getting used to being there. You know, it's such a different place, it takes a lot of getting used to. But this last time I went, just earlier in the year, I went with Vajrashira, and actually Rajamuni as well came. I kind of had a bit more of a feeling for how to get around. And I kind of took a little bit more of an interest, particularly in Indian order members. So I was there for an international convention at Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha gained enlightenment, and also an international council meeting. The international council is a body of people who meet from all over the world in different parts of our community to try and maintain a sense of unity and harmony. This time I wanted to really connect with the Indians a lot more. Just for the pleasure of it, I quite like Indians. I don't know why, but I just quite like them, generally speaking. I've never met one I haven't liked. I don't know why. It's weird, isn't it? But I really like them. And also, I just wanted to get a bit more of a sense of what their experience was of Ambedkar in terms of how they felt about him and how they saw his place in their own Dharma lives. You know, because he's a sort of a For Indian Buddhists, for Indian Dalit Buddhists, he's like a towering figure. He's a very, very big presence. And I was trying to get a sense of why that was. Why that is, even. So if we could just give you an example. So, you know, there'll always be an image of Ambedkar at any meeting. So at the convention, there's a picture of, an image of the Buddha. There's a picture of Bante and there's a picture of Ambedkar. And before every event, they garland the picture of Ambedkar. That's the part, and then when he claps, it's a sort of part of their tradition. So he's like a kind of living presence, even though he's been dead for more than 60 years. I wanted to kind of get a bit more of a feeling for why they're so devoted to him, and I wanted to understand what we can learn about him from a Western perspective. So what can we draw from their experience in terms of our lives? In the Dhamma in the West. So that in a way, this talk is a kind of an answer to that question. So it's basically, you know, what I've come up with so far. You see what I mean? So it's kind of very much feels like a work in progress. I still feel like because India is such a complex place, and the history is so complex, and the Buddhist movement there is so complex, it sort of feels like I'm still trying to understand how it all works really. Because I've only spent a very short amount of time there, and I'm not involved with people on an ongoing basis who live there, so it's sort of like it feels like a little bit of a remove. But I think I've got a few things I can say that might be of interest. I was thinking as well that all talks, unless you're a Buddha, any talk you give about Buddhism will be a work in progress, really. So I don't feel bad about that. I also think, in a way, I've got a lot to learn. And there's also, I'm aware of the fact there's a lot of order members who are in a much better, they're in a much better position to give a talk about this than I am. But anyway, you stuck with me tonight. Yeah, and actually on that trip, I read a couple of other books. I read a book, I reread Ambedkar and Buddhism, and there's also, as part of Sankaracharya's complete works, a whole lot of talks he gave in the early 80s in India have been published in book form. And they get very, very interesting to contrast the way he communicates the Dharma there to the way he communicates it here. It's a lot of the same principles, but the approach is quite different. It's like he comes at it from a different angle and he emphasizes different things, which in itself is quite interesting. And then I've also read a little bit by the man himself, in particular a book that he wrote. Well, he wrote it as actually a talk that he never delivered in 1935. It's one of his, from the point of view of the Dalits, it's one of his most important works, which is called The Annihilation of Caste. It's a pretty strong title, isn't it? Annihilation. And it's extremely trenchant in its style. It's like a demolition job. It's quite incredible to read, actually. And it's recently been published with an introduction by Arundhati Roy, you know, the Indian author she won the Booker Prize a number of years ago. And she's written an introduction to that book, or that pamphlet or talk. It's called The Doctor and the Saint. That's like a book in itself. It's quite substantial. And it's talking about, the doctor is Dr. Ambedkar. The saint, I listened to a talk from her and she says, I use that word ironically, is Gandhi, who is a much more checkered character than we're led to believe in the West. Much, much, much more, well, I'll say it, devious than we think. He's actually quite a complex character and not at all what he appears. And himself and Ambedkar were bitter political opponents. And she makes the point in her book that, in a way, you can't really talk about Gandhi's career without talking about Ambedkar. And you can't talk about Ambedkar without talking about Gandhi. It's quite interesting when you get into it. In a way, it's a whole story in itself that as soon as you sort of say anything negative about Gandhi, people say, "Wow, Gandhi!" But in a way, if I was to explain why, it would take ages. But if you're interested, you can read the book. Yeah, it's really quite fascinating. So, of course, you know, it's Buddhist Action Month, and the theme for Buddhist Action Month is transforming self and transforming world. So it's particularly highlighting the power of the Dharma to transform society. So Vedashura thought, and I thought it would be good to have a talk on Ambedkar. Because, you know, his life and work really epitomises this. His whole life's work was about transforming Indian society. That was his reason for being. That was what he was about. Yeah. So what I want to do is, that's just by way of kind of preamble. What I want to do is give a sketch of his life and his career, and then talk about, what I think we can learn from him in terms of, being Buddhists here in this country and in the West, the cultural West. Hopefully also get, not just a sense of what we can learn, but maybe what we can actually do as well, if you see what I mean. So he was born, Ambedkar was born in 1891, and he was the 14th child of his mother and father. And he was born in Maharashtra, which is west central India. So it's kind of in the middle on the left, if you're looking at the map. The main city in Maharashtra, the biggest city, is Mumbai, which is, you know, one of the biggest cities in the world. And he was born in the Maha caste, and which is an untouchable caste, so-called. So literally, you know, being an untouchable means that if somebody touches you from a different caste, a higher caste, then they're polluted by touching you. They're besmirched. It's really quite an incredible concept. But that's why they're called untouchables. There's also people who are unseeables. And even there's people apparently who are referred to as unapproachables. So there's 4,000 different castes apparently in India, and they're all graded. I'm telling you this because in a way you have to understand this in order to understand who Ambedkar is and why he had the life he had. So there's all these castes, and they're all graded. Every single one is graded. If you're in a caste, you're either higher than another caste or lower than another caste. Everybody's graded, and they're all completely discrete. You can't marry in between castes. So they remain completely defined, completely discrete. The Brahmins are at the top, and technically speaking, untouchables are actually outside the caste system. They don't even have a caste, if you look at it from a certain, you know, traditional perspective. So it's all these different grades. So, and Baker talks about it as a system of graded inequality. Everyone's got rights and duties, but the people at the bottom have got much more duties than they've got rights, and vice versa. And part of the system is that you're born into your caste, so you're in your particular caste because of your birth, because of your parents and their caste. And of course, they've both got the same caste because you can't marry outside of your caste. And your caste has a particular function in society that you have to fulfill. That this is the way, this is the tradition. When I say tradition, I mean it's cast iron. You can't wriggle out of it without extreme difficulty. So, for example, you might be a sweeper caste, or there's a caste which is manual scavengers, which basically means they clean up other people's shit, and that's their job. That's what it is their whole lives. It's just incredible, actually. God, it's really crazy. That's what they do. Their whole lives, they clean up other people's shit with their hands. You know, they don't have any rubber gloves or anything. It's just absolutely incredible. And what's incredible, like I said a minute ago, is that if you don't do your caste duty, it's irreligious. You're breaking not just you're going against the religion of the land, and it's just incredibly repressive regime. And Baker's father was in the military. And he was in the British military. So, of course, back then, India was part of the British Empire. Well, as was Ireland. to some extent, if you were involved in the British system, there was some of the strictures of caste were less oppressive. Yeah? So because his father was in the military, he was able to get an education. So again, one of the strictures of the caste system, that if you're a low caste, you can't become educated. It's against your caste dharma, as they call it. They use the word we use, but in a completely different sense. It's against your caste dharma to be educated. And there's some horrific traditional texts that tell you what happens. Like, for example, if you hear the Vedas, the sacred texts, if an untouchable hears them, they're supposed to have molten lead poured in their ears and all this kind of horrific, barbaric stuff. Anyway, but he was able to get an education, and he matriculated from what we would call secondary school. He was the first untouchable ever to do that. And he went abroad to study. So he went to London. He studied at the London School of Economics, and he also studied in Columbia University. He had three PhDs, which is where the doctor comes from. So he came back to India, the most educated man in India. So he's from the bottom, but he's sort of risen to the top through his own, you know, application. And also, you know, it must have been quite an incredible thing to leave that environment in India, go to New York. He's foreign, but he's not an untouchable. And then he came back to it. And there's these stories about, you know, people. He worked for the government in Baroda, which is a now defunct state, which is just north of Mumbai. And because they paid for his education, he was obliged to work in the civil service there. And one of the stories is that people were frightened of being polluted by him. So they would have all been caste Hindus. In other words, when you say caste Hindus, it means that they're sort of higher up the pecking order. They wouldn't want to put a file on his desk, because they'd be pissed. So they just kind of, they come over and just sort of throw the files at him, you know. This would be terribly degrading stuff, and you couldn't find anywhere to live, because even the people who belong to other religions wouldn't have him as a tenant. So he couldn't find anywhere to live. You know, this man who had three PhDs. I mean, it's incredible. It's just really quite, it's hard to believe. Anyway, he qualified as a barrister. So he's just this incredibly in its list all the things: politician, economist, jurist, barrister. This is all these things that he was able to do. And when he came back, this was in the mid-1920s, he became politically active against casteism, against untouchability. And there were a couple of particular things that he did which he's renowned for. From some Indian people's perspective, he'd been notorious for. One of them was in a place called Mahad. There was one of the British passed legislation that public places... you weren't allowed to discriminate in terms of caste. So there's this big tank. So in India they have these big tanks. I'm not sure about this, but I suspect that what they're there for is to catch the water from the monsoon. So there's these huge big kind of pools in the middle of villages, and people would take water from these tanks. But the untouchables were forbidden from taking water from this tank, even though it was public property. It was like belonged to the municipal authority or the county council or whatever. And people were told they were, untouchables, said they weren't allowed to take water. So he went, with a whole bunch of his people, went and took water from the tank. And it's just bizarre. But anyway, so there's an outcry about this. How could these people do these things and pollute our water supply? Just by, dipping into it and drinking it, and it was pollution. So they emptied something like 108 pots of cow dung, cow urine, curds and other substances from a cow into the tank to purify it. It's just really... And he was terribly... You can imagine how insulting that would be. That's animal shit purifies your drinking of water. I mean, it's just mad. Anyway, but it's just the power of ignorance is just... You really kind of... When it's institutionalized like that, you really kind of notice that much more strongly. Nice. Yeah, anyway, and the other thing he did something really radical, which was he burnt a sacred text. It wasn't sacred to him. He burnt something called the Manusmriti, which is an ancient text which prescribes all these different conventions about how people are supposed to treat each other. So he burnt it. And quite a number of people all over India burnt it, which you can imagine. It'd be like people here getting the Bible, middle of like Collins Street, and just chucking it on a bonfire. It would upset people. So that's what he did. So again, quite radical. He was very, very, all the way along, he never incited violence. This is one of the really, really important things about him as a revolutionary figure, is he was totally opposed to violence. And it's really interesting that Gandhi, of course, is the one who's famous for that. Mm-hmm. But Gandhi actually supported the caste system. And the caste system, people follow the caste system through fear of violence. If you, it's not just that you're not allowed to break out of your caste duty. If you do, you will, people are regularly, even still, raped, murdered, burnt, all this kind of stuff. So Gandhi actually supported that quite actively. He wanted an India where caste was the governing social principle. So even though, he's famous for this non-violence, he supported a system which relies on coercion to enforce it. It's really quite shocking, but that's the truth of the matter, I'm afraid. In 1935, he said something really, really radical again. And what he said was, "I was born a Hindu, but I will not die a Hindu." And he started to encourage his people to start looking around for a different faith. And this sent shockwaves through India. And it's a bit let me see if I can explain this quickly according to my understanding of it. But what was happening here is he started to get quite a strong independence movement in the 1930s. And they were talking in terms of kind of home rule, so that the governance of India would be governed from India, but still part of the empire. That's the way it was being talked about. So representation became a really big issue. So how were the people to be represented? The people of this enormous nation to be represented? And it was decided that there'd be separate seats for different religions, because religion was such an important part of people's lives in India. they decided you needed to have, you know, constituencies for the Hindus, constituencies for the Muslims, constituencies for the Sikhs. So what Gandhi was very concerned, and his crowd were very concerned with, was that if the untouchables kind of separated off, it would decimate the numbers of their constituency. Though, like, you know, it's interesting, Brahmins are only 6% of the Indian population, and the whole untouchables and the lower castes are massive. It's like, you know, 44% or some incredible number. So they were worried that if they broke away, that would basically remove their power base. So they were very, very keen to keep the untouchables kind of ignorant and uneducated. So Gandhi, in a way, started putting himself forward as the representative of the untouchables. Outrageous. Really outrageous. Really outrageous, carry on. Even though he didn't have any, there was no basis for that. So that was why him and Baker saying that he was going to leave Hinduism was such a radical thing to say, and sent, like the way it's described as, you know, sent shockwaves through India. So he's really, and there's a whole other story about a fast that Gandhi went on a fast to basically, again, to get his way, and they were in a standoff. That's a whole other story. This was something called the Pune Pact, which is in the early 30s, which again is a whole other story, but it's a very, very interesting history. What's interesting as well is Mbeki doesn't appear, you know the film, the famous film? Yeah. Mbeki doesn't appear in the film. It doesn't even have a walk-on part, which is, you know, according to Arundhati Roy, it's just a travesty of history that, you cannot understand Gandhi without understanding the relationship with Mbeki. So that film, she says, is just basically, it's a fiction, basically. So his whole myth making was part of his kind of political genius, really. Gandhi, really. Yeah. Anyway, so and there was quite a movement of higher caste people who wanted to reform the caste system because of this concern about breaking up the constituency. There quite a number of quite high profile higher caste people wanted to reform caste. And they had a conference, one of these organisations, they invited Mbeki to come to speak to them, which is quite a thing. He wrote this piece, this address called Annihilation of Caste, and they wanted him to submit it before he gave it, and he did, and they said, sorry, we're revoking our invitation. The history of it's incredible. So he thought, okay, well, I'm going to publish it myself. So that's what he did. He bought this thing out. And he basically says in it, that you can't reform a caste system. It's inherently iniquitous. You can't fiddle with it. You've just got to completely get rid of it. And I'll read you a little bit from it later on. It's quite, because it gives you a bit of a sense of his style. Again, this was a flashpoint with Gandhi. They had a whole exchange about this. So of course in there was a Second World War, and after the Second World War, England, it ran out of money, bankrupt, knackered, and they couldn't maintain an empire in the way that they had, so they let India go in 1947. And because of his qualifications, Mbeki became the first law minister of independent India and was the chair of the drafting committee to draft the Indian constitution. So really, like in terms of secular history in India, that's his sort of crowning achievement. So there's a big statue of Mbeki in the parliament buildings of Delhi, and he's got the constitution under one arm. He's kind of pointing his arm, finger up like that. But he's got it says the constitution of India. It's got under his arm. But that's what he's known for. He eventually resigned from parliament because he just couldn't. He was trying to reform Hinduism. There's something called the Hindu Code Bill, but everyone was blocking it. So he just resigned, kind of really in disgust, in the early 50s. And then in 1956, so 21 years after he said he wasn't, I was born a Hindu but I won't die one, he converted to Buddhism. And in the ceremony in Nagpur, right in the center of India. And like I say, that's a whole other story, a fascinating story. But yeah, him and 380,000 other people went for refuge to the Three Jewels. Because that's what he advised them. Incredible loyalty people had to him. This is another thing that's really fascinating, is that people would have done anything that he told them to do because they had such faith in him. So if he'd told them, if he'd invoked an armed struggle, people would have taken up arms. It's quite an incredible thing. And they were so desperate that you can imagine the temptation to do that. It's like, we've got no rights, we've got no power, no one's going to give us any power, no one's going to give us any rights, what are we going to do? A lot of peoples around the world are faced with that kind of decision, and then people take up arms because that's the only way they feel that they can actually get any kind of respect or rights. But he never did that. Tragically, he died 6 weeks after that. So after he converted, 6 weeks later he died. He had diabetes. He was at 64 years of age. He died. And terrible loss for those people, because they're just converted, and the caste Hindus were utterly derisive of that. They just thought it was a political stunt. And Bhante even talks about, because our teacher Sangharaksha, went to these villages and taught these people what they converted to, because they didn't really know much about the Dharma, and there were very few people who were willing to teach them. So he went and taught them what he could about the Three Jewels. And he said, he gets the local lads kind of, jeering at them, you can imagine that kind of thing. So that's the movement that, continues to this day, this Buddhist movement. And then, in the 70s, in terms of the Triratna kind of story, in the late 1970s, a few order members went out there and started Triratna activities within that wider kind of Buddhist movement. So that's a kind of a bit of the story. Obviously, it's one of those stories that you can say a lot more. You can say an awful lot more. And there's loads of stuff I haven't had a chance to look into. But that's the kind of broad sort of sweep of his life. So I just want to go into the second part, which is what we can learn from all of this. So one of the things I think that comes out in this story is, what we can learn from Dr. Ambedkar. I was going to say as well, you could think of this as the challenges of Dr. Ambedkar. It's like, it's almost something when you engage in any way with his life, it's like he presents a challenge. As so you can say it's inspiring, but it's also very deeply kind of challenging. So one of the things that I think it's kind of obvious, but one of the things I think we can learn is, don't be defined or limited by your origins. So, sometimes we think, oh, well, I've had a bit of a hard time and I've come from a difficult place in my life. And no doubt we have. All of us have got our own particular experience of dukkha. But when you hear about, the adversity that he faced, it kind of makes you think, it's not that bad. And it's interesting talking to Indian order members just about, I actually asked them, what was it like being a Buddhist, and the people tell these horrific stories, just nasty, really nastiness, really horrible nastiness. So part of that, I think, is part of what he was able to do is to not let what other people thought about him to find about what he thought about himself. So I think this is one of the really incredible things about him, is he just didn't let other people's ideas about him define how he thought about himself. So there's this incredible kind of dignity that he just was able to somehow develop from his own side, as it were. I mean, obviously he was inspired by people. He was exposed through his education to some pretty impressive people, both actually and also through books and history and so on, like the Buddha, for example. But he this incredible sense of sort of self-possession and dignity. I mean, he definitely would be a true individual in Sangharakshita's terms. Bhante includes him in a in a list of great Buddhists of the 20th century, along with a few other well-known Buddhists. Well, not that well-known in some cases. And it's interesting that when he was, after his conversion, one of the things he said about it was like, I feel like I've been reborn. Which is quite, there's a particular ring about that, because in terms of the caste system, they actually talk about your jati. So jati means birth. So for him to say, I've been reborn, it's got an additional kind of power, I think. And it reminded me of that piece in the Bodhicaryavatara, where it says, it's talking about the Bodhicitta, the arising of the Bodhicitta. It says, today my birth has borne fruit, and my humanity has been fulfilled. Today I am reborn in the Buddha family, and I am now a son of the Buddha. And now I must live up to my birth, and by my actions must place no stain upon that spotless family. So you kind of get that sense of, you know, him sort of being reborn and just living according to what he knew he really was, and trying to enable other people to live according to who they really were, not what other people were telling them about how dirty and filthy and polluting they were. So that's my first point. Don't be defined or limited by your origins. The second one sort of occurred to me is that being a principled politician is a real possibility. I'm fairly cynical about politics and politicians, just in terms of the seeming predominance of self-interest and how it seems that what a lot of politicians are doing is just perpetuating their own self-interest or the interests of their group. And while obviously Mbeki was very concerned with the interests of his group, the community to which he belonged, he had a much bigger vision, which I'll come to in a moment. And one of the points that Subhuti makes about Mbeki is that he was just an incredibly upright person, incredibly ethical person, very moral person. Even his bitterest enemies didn't accuse him of corruption, which apparently is quite a thing in India, because it's an utterly corrupt place. So, but not even his bitterest enemies would accuse them of corruption, which is quite something in India, apparently. And it's very much, you get the sense of him that he was very concerned that the means were not opposed to the ends. So he wanted, you know, he had a vision for India, and he didn't want to act in a way that contravened that. Important, I think, that he didn't want the means of his life to be out of harmony with the end that he was aiming for. So yes, very, very upright man. So that's my second point, is that being a principled politician is a real possibility. The third point I wanted to talk about in relation to him was that we can learn is turning anger into clarity. Turning anger into clarity. So wisdom, of course, prajna, in the Buddhist tradition, has very much got the connotation of cutting away delusion, confusion, crooked thinking, self-interest, all that kind of thing. So it involves a clear analysis of what's going on, a clear coming into view of what's important, and then a way of pragmatically moving towards what's important. So very, very, a real kind of clarity. So in the Dhammapada, there's that phrase, that verse where it says, with the sword of wisdom, make war on Mara. Which is quite strong. It's like there's a real sense of kind of, well, a sword is an instrument of war. And he says, make war on Mara. And you do get this sense when you read some of his material, there's a real sense of a kind of a battle going on. And that's his kind of, it's almost like he's channeling his anger into that. This thing, Annihilation of Caste, it's quite thrilling to read. It's just so, it's kind of got this searing quality, like something's being burnt. Really incredible thing to read. This is, I think, one of the things that Mbeki was really clear on, is that the root of dukkha is ignorance. That's what you need to focus your energy on.
not to get involved in conflicts for the sake of it with other people, but to get in contact. I mean, it was inevitable he'd come into conflict with other people because their views differed from his, but he very much directed it at the views themselves. And this clarity comes out in Annihilation of Caste. Like I said, I read it when I was over there, which kind of gave it an extra punch, because you're in here in your environment. You can ask people about it. It was great, actually. Some of these order members we have over there, they're really, really, really well informed about Ambedkar. So anything you want, you just ask, so that thing you did, this was this and this and this person and that person. They give you the whole background. It's really, really great. So it's really thrilling. I was reading it, the Annihilation of Caste with another order member, and I kind of swapped notes. It's really good. So like I said, one of the things he did when he wrote this piece that he was going to deliver was basically saying, look, if you want to reform caste, you've got to go a lot deeper than what you think you do. So one of the things they talked about was interdining, so different castes dining with each other and intermarriage. And I thought, if they do that, that'll really help. That'll make a big difference. He's saying, no, you've got to go a lot further. And So I'll just read you a little section. I just mentioned the word shastra. So a shastra is basically a Hindu text. And a lot of these shastras were contained these sort of traditional observances, which basically make up the Hindu tradition. So this is what Ambedkar says. Caste is a notion. It is a state of mind. So this here again, he's directing it at the Mitchaditi, the wrong view. The destruction of caste does not therefore mean the destruction of a physical barrier. It means a notional change. Caste may be bad. Caste may lead to conduct so gross as to be called man's inhumanity to man. All the same, it must be recognized that the Hindus observe caste not because they are inhuman or wrong-headed. They observe caste because they are deeply religious. People are not wrong in observing caste. In my view, what is wrong is their religion, which has inculcated this notion of caste. If this is correct, then obviously the enemy you must grapple with is not the people who observe caste, but the shastras which teach them this religion of caste. Criticizing and ridiculing people for not interdining or intermarrying, or occasionally holding intercaste dinners and celebrating intercaste marriages, is a futile method of achieving the desired end. The real remedy is to destroy the belief in the sanctity of the shastras. How do you expect to succeed if you allow the shastras to continue to mould the beliefs and opinions of the people? Not to question the authority of the shastras, to permit the people to believe in their sanctity and their sanctions, and then to blame the people and to criticise them for their acts as being irrational and inhuman, is an incongruous way of carrying on social reform. Reformers working for the removal of untouchability, including Mahatma Gandhi, do not seem to realize that the acts of the people are merely the results of their beliefs inculcated in their minds by the shastras, and that people will not change their conduct until they cease to believe in the sanctity of the shastras on which their conduct is founded. It goes on like that for pages, and it's just like, it's searing. And it's very, very clear. There's another fantastic passage where he talks about the difference between rules and principles, and how you can never have a religion of rules, because rules are never adequate. You have to have a religion of principles. It's really, really brilliant, really clear. It's really, really great. So what I think part of this clarity was like I said, this intellectual rigor. And one of the things that Arundhati Roy says about Ambedkar, when she's talking about how you can't understand Ambedkar without understanding Gandhi, and you can't understand Gandhi without understanding Ambedkar, is that Ambedkar consistently challenged him, Gandhi that is, intellectually, politically, and morally, she says. It's interesting, after he writes this, Gandhi responds, and then Ambedkar responds to Gandhi's response. So you get this exchange of letters. It's very, very interesting. But yeah, like I say, the anger was directed to cultivating clarity, not stirring up hatred and violence. I mean, in a way he did, but but in a way, I'm not sure that was his fault. If you challenge somebody's deeply held prejudices, they're not usually going to take that very nicely, certainly. So this is the other this leads on to the next point I want to make, which is that in terms of what we can learn from him, is that a peaceful revolution is possible. I was quite moved when I wrote this, actually, because, I mean, we kind of take for granted that revolution means violence. You look around the world, you see revolutions, and usually it's an uprising involving people getting killed, executed, etc., etc., and a new regime coming into force. But what Mbeki started with, it was a peaceful revolution. And he was, by all accounts, a very angry person. I just Googled him, just because I was kind of looking at stuff, and I Googled, you know, Mbeki and clicked on images. And usually he looks serious. You know, that picture there is quite typical. There's a very few pictures where he's even smiling. But usually, sometimes he's got this kind of scowl. And Bante describes him in that kind of way when he meets him. He says the sides of his mouth were turned down and just really, really angry, you know, because of the way people have been treated. Not just him, but his people. And Bante talks about him being quite sort of irascible and giving his people who come to his office and giving them a real telling off, you know. But he never, like I say, I've already said it, but he never gave way to violence. Like he could have, when you imagine what he could have done, how he could have responded, it's really, you know, India would be a bloodbath. I mean, it already kind of was at certain times, but it would have, you know, just the most incredible violence. And people, it seems that his people, his followers, had just a total faith in him. So if he'd said, this is what we're going to do, everyone would just go, okay. So it's really interesting about the conversion, because some people think, you know, did people actually convert to Buddhism out of their own volition? But it's really interesting that what he did is, first of all, he converted. So he took the refuges from the senior most bhikkhu, the senior most monk in India. And after he'd done that, he said to the assembly, all these 380,000 people who were gathered in this place, does anybody want to do this as well? Of course they all stood up, but you know, he definitely offered them the option. They did it out of faith in him. They did it, which is an act of personal volition, if you see what I mean. So it's a very interesting contrast with Gandhi here about who was the real practicer, who really practiced ahimsa. Very interesting. So a peaceful revolution is possible. And in a way, it's more than possible. It's actually happening. Again, like, you don't hear about it, but this is happening in India. This is an incredible movement. And more communities are actually converting to Buddhism. Not just, originally it was just the Maha caste, which is Mbeki's own community, but more and more communities realize that this is the way forward. And increasingly that they're converting to Buddhism. So, for example, you get these people called the Adivasis, but they're kind of, like, sometimes called tribal people. They have this really blunt, the technical term is other backward classes. That's how they refer to in India. It's like no political correctness. You must be from one of the backward classes. You know, it's just they're totally like, that's what they call the other backward classes. They're called OBCs. And the people who live very, very rough lives, you know, and these people, some of them are converting to Buddhism as well. And, obviously it's slow progress, but it's real progress. You get the sense of Mbeki that he's playing a very long game. So, you know, you can imagine that with violence, you might be able to achieve something short term, but the legacy of that, and I mean, you look at what's happened in this country in terms of the legacy of violence, and you have to live with that. You have to live with the fact that the leaders of the country are people who, you know, kill people. You know, and you have to live with that. It ripples on. But he obviously didn't want. He didn't want that. So I've got two more points. The next one is that real societal change has to be based solidly on spiritual and ethical principles. So it's not enough to change laws. It's not enough to write constitutions. As valuable as that is, so he did that. He literally drafted the whole constitution of the country. He tried to change the laws. The untouchability is outlawed in the constitution, yet it still persists. And of course it persists because people's attitudes persist. And one of the things that actually shocked me when I went to India and I heard talk to people is the level of caste discrimination that still exists. Like, it's often talked about, well, in the villages it's very bad, but in the cities it's not so bad. But there was a talk from an Indian order member called Amit Amati, who's a consultant oncologist in a large Mumbai hospital. She's really quite high up. And she gave a talk about the discrimination that she experienced with her colleagues, who are, you know, educated doctors in the biggest urban centre in India. And the same prejudice was experienced by her. Really shocking stuff, actually. People just treating her really abominably, you know, really in an inhuman way. And, you know, and it's like, you know, you turn up to work, like she became the head of her department. She turns up to work and everyone just sort of scowled at her. You can imagine just living with people who just hate you for who you are. Horrible. And still goes on. I was really shocked, actually, that in a hospital in a big urban city, educated people, that kind of prejudice still exists. So, you know, like, I mean, you know, it's funny. Well, funny. It's by way of contrast, you think, like, I think I've got, you know, like a cross to bear, you know, being a gay person growing up in a provincial New Zealand town. And that's hard. You know, it is hard. But, like, it's kind of nothing compared to, like, what the kind of just the horror of what people have to experience over there. So, yeah, so it's very important to change laws. I mean, you know, in Ireland, it's just interesting noticing, you know, the two referendums that we've had and what a difference that's made to people's lives, just to know that those laws aren't there anymore, and that it's a real clear signal, but it's not sufficient. So this is, and I'm sort of following Subuti here. This is one of the points he makes, is that that there's a connection between a free and just society and a moral culture. There's a connection between a free and just society and a moral culture. So that's the Buddhist vision. That's what the Buddha communicated. Often it's talked about that the five precepts are the basis for a just society. If everyone practices the five precepts, you have a just society. If they don't, you've got chaos. So it's sort of the basis of a good and just society. So the law, police can only control a criminal minority. They can't control the whole of society. And obviously, it's been demonstrated all over the world that the police can't push against the whole of society. So society needs to be founded on moral principles. So, you know, he didn't have a lot of time for Marx and Bucer, because he said that there needs to be something more than just economics. He saw that human beings were spiritual beings, as it were, and that any system of moral principles needed to have a foundation in an understanding of the meaning and purpose of existence. So it needed to have some kind of reference of, well, what are we all doing here? And if it didn't, then society would fragment. And he thought that the conclusion he came to, and he really looked into it over 20 years, well, in a way over the whole of his life, but the best place to find that was in the Buddha Dharma and the Buddha's teaching. And he thought that the Buddha Dharma was the foundation for true democracy. And Subuti makes the point that, in a way, at the moment, liberal democracy is under threat. It's under threat from religious fundamentalism and authoritarian populist nationalism. And just as mere liberalism, the basis on the way our Western democracies are based, doesn't have much behind it on its own. It needs actually something behind it to give it real muscle. And Baker's conviction was that was found in the Buddha Dharma, in a real sense of a true ethical system, a true ethical basis for a society. And without that, you know, it eventually would crumble. It would just give way to those other forces. And again, one of the other things about Baker is that he had a vision for not just the uplift of his own community, but for the whole of... he talked about this phrase, enlightened India, an enlightened society that was informed by the values of the three jewels. So it's like the uplift of his people wasn't the end point. That was just, in a way, what got him going. But he had a much wider vision for society. And I think this is the other thing that's really probably the most important thing for us to learn from India, is that transforming the world is as integral to the Dharma as is transforming self. So I think that's one of the things we really need to take. Transforming the world is as integral to the Dharma as is transforming self. And this is our tradition. This is our Buddhist tradition that goes right back to the Buddha. That's what he taught, and it's certainly what Sangharakshita taught. Not just what he said, but also his example. And I think, you know, in talking about Buddhist Action Month, which is what's happening this June, we need to be a little bit careful. We can talk about it in terms of, well, you know, in June we do lots of altruistic stuff, but the rest of the year we just kind of look after ourselves. And if we're not careful, we can start thinking about it like that. Really what Buddhist Action Month is about is highlighting the altruistic dimension of the Dharma, which is intrinsic to it. It's not sort of like an optional add-on. That would be really great if we did a bit of this, but, you know, basically what we're doing is something else. So I think we need to be careful about thinking of it in that kind of way. So if we're not careful, we start seeing the altruistic dimension of Buddhism exclusively in terms of changing the world in a sort of in an obvious external way. As important as that is, you know, it's important that people start eating animals. All that stuff is important, that people become aware of the climate change. That's really, really important. But you know, helping out with a meditation course is as much as participating in the Dharma revolution as much as becoming a vegan. I think we forget that. But, you know, that's how people's minds and attitudes are changed, by engaging with the Dharma. That's how society has changed. It's really, really important to, you know, to stand up and say stuff, and we need to do a lot more of that in terms of putting a Buddhist voice out there into society. But, you know, actually, people are going to be transformed, their attitudes, by coming into contact with Buddhists and communicating with Buddhists and meeting a spiritual community. That's really our kind of cutting edge, is developing and cultivating a spiritual community. That's particularly Sangharakshita's vision. And actually it was Ambedkar's as well. He talked about the need for a new kind of bhikkhu, who is much more involved in society. I'm going to read you a little bit from Ambedkar in a sec. We need to be a little bit careful. I mean, Maitreya Bandi pointed this out a few weeks ago. We need to be careful of this idea of changing the world, because it always sounds like it's somewhere else when you say, I'm changing the world, or I want to change the world. It always sounds like it's over there. But you need to start from, obviously, what's here, that you know, changing the nature of your own mind, for a start, changing your relationships. It just reminds me of that phrase. I don't know if people still use that in the environmental movement, of thinking globally and acting locally, which is actually quite a good phrase, I think. But yeah, it comes back to the mind. So that's one of the things we can learn, I think. And that's one of the things I really appreciate about meeting Indian Order members. So we, in the West, we tend to start with kind of personal problems. So they come along to Buddhism because we feel a bit lost, or we feel depressed, or we feel anxious, and all those kinds of things, which are perfectly valid reasons. It's all dukkha. What's interesting is in India, what people come for is answers to social problems. It's the kind of entry point is kind of the opposite. And it's really, really interesting just to be in that environment where people are coming from a different point of view. So, like I was saying earlier, I was reading some of Banzo's lectures that he gave in the early 80s, the beginnings of our movement. And one of the things he's sort of answering, one of the questions he's answering, which obviously was on people's minds at that time, was, how do you keep energy for the movement going? How do you keep energy for the Buddhist movement going? And he says, what you need to do is to meditate. You need to develop pritti, you need to develop rapture, to give you energy for the Buddhist movement. And like, it was just kind of the other way around. So usually it's like, you know, people learn to meditate, and then it's a bit like, okay, it needs to be an altruistic dimension now. But for over there, it was like, there's this, people really need to see the value and the importance of the Buddhist movement. And in order to sustain that, they need to develop their own meditation practice. So it's like two wings of the same animal. Yeah, very interesting. So yeah, so for us, probably the danger is selfishness. So Buddhism just becomes a kind of, a, you know, a sort of helpful add-on to a consumer lifestyle. But you know, obviously the Dharma can be the means, it can just become a means to strengthen and improve our egoism, not transcend it. So recently I've been looking at another Buddhist teaching, which is the eight mind train verses, which actually comes from the Tibetan tradition. And Pavar actually had the book that he did some study with Bante on. And there's a note from Bante that says, unselfishness is the key to spiritual development. Really, really pithy. Unselfishness is the key to spiritual development. And I think what we need to do, I'm finishing up now, don't worry. What we need to do is recognize the power of what we already have to change society. In a sense, we've already got what we need. We just need to go into it more and more deeply, I think. Have confidence in that. See the potential in our spiritual community and share that with other people. So what I want to do to finish is to read you a little bit from Mbeki. But I just want to just remind you about where we've kind of come the last hour or so. So I just started by just talking about, this is life really, what he did, the different things he did in his 64 years on this earth. And then talked about what we can learn from him. So what we can learn from him, well, some of the things, I mean, this is just a kind of a things that occurred to me, is not to be defined or limited by our origins, that being a principled politician is a real possibility, to turn anger into clarity, not violence, that a peaceful revolution is possible, that real societal change has to be solidly based on spiritual and ethical principles, and that transforming the world is as integral to the Dharma as is transforming self. So in 1950, Mbeki wrote a piece for the Mahabodhi Journal called Buddha and the Future of His Religion. And Bante often refers to that in these talks. It's quite interesting because he makes some quite important points that give the impression that kind of influenced Bante's thinking. I mean, Bante would have been only 25 at that point. So it obviously has gone in at some level. And he's talking here about how he's saying that Buddhist countries, remembering that India at that time was not a Buddhist country, that Buddhist countries need to put a lot more money and effort into spreading Buddhism. And that's what he's kind of talking about. And I think in a way, even though we're not a Buddhist country, we are a Buddhist community and we do have resources, at least in terms of manpower or woman power, not maybe in terms of money, but anyway, we are able to do something about the spirit of Buddhism. So I think in a way it applies to us as well, at least in principle. So I'll just read you this and then we'll finish. The time seems quite propitious for the spread of Buddhism. There was a time when religion was part of one's own inheritance. At one time, a boy or a girl inherited the religion of his or her parent along with the property of the parent. There was no question of examining the merit and virtues of religion. Sometimes the heir did question whether the property left by the parents was worth taking, but no heir was there to question, that's heir as an H-E-I-R by the way, but no heir was there to question whether the religion of his or her parents was worth having. Times seems to have changed. Many persons throughout the world have exhibited an unprecedented piece of courage with regard to an inheritance of their religion. Many have, as a result of the influence of scientific inquiry, come to the conclusion that religion is an error which ought to be given up. There are others who, as a result of the Marxian teaching, have come to the conclusion that religion is opium, which induces the poor people to submit to the domination of the rich and should be discarded. Whatever be the causes, the fact remains that people have developed an inquiring mind in respect of religion. And the question whether religion is at all worth having, and if so, which religion is worth having, are questions which are uppermost in the minds of those who dare to think about the subject. Time has come. What is wanted is will. If the countries which are Buddhist can develop the will to spread Buddhism, the task of spreading Buddhism will not be difficult. They must realize the duty of a Buddhist is not merely to be a good Buddhist. His duty is to spread Buddhism. They must believe that to spread Buddhism is to serve mankind.